Being the last speaker, of course, I'm going to have the advantage of being able to play off what's already done and the disadvantage of having to repeat what everybody else has already said, but I'll try to limit my comments to focus on what I really want to get across here. The area-wide reduction in pesticide load has been pointed out as why stink bugs are now area-wide pest and back. And there was a recent paper in Science that tends to back that up that was done on wide areas a couple weeks ago. And their emergent property in cotton in Science, and this was based on like 1.3 million hectares of cotton with GMOs implemented over 10 years, and they had, they're seeing myriad outbreaks as a result of this. And down here in the right-hand corner, you can see a place where we can test this hypothesis, if we wish, in the Rio Grande Valley, where the boll weevil is still going strong. The stink bugs that are the major problems in the southeast are these. We've talked about that. They're very widely distributed, including Leptoglossus phallopus. There are lots of other species, and we've talked about Pisidorus and Halomorpha as invasive species who are on the rise. There are a lot more out there that could come. The problem is that stink bugs are in general very tolerant to pesticides. We don't have left any really extremely effective insecticides, and we still have the problem with lack of efficient monitoring detection devices for these other species. And I left off Eucystis there because I think that my trap is gaining some traction and it does have some particular application. So given those problems though, and the likely continuation of that, I turned my attention to trying to develop some alternative strategies related to habitat manipulation. I always wanted to be an engineer. I didn't realize that I just became one, so I should talk about ecological engineering, I guess. Basically, what I'm looking for was something that was scale, meaning size of the farm, and philosophy neutral, meaning applicable across a wide range of growers, from backyard gardeners, organic growers, all the way up to conventional growers. And with an idea that this would be the focal point of the implementation of multiple tactics, including behavioral tools. So the background of this is that adults do overwinter for the most part. They're prolificus. Maybe counterintuitively, they are very finicky about what they feed on. Most plants they feed on, I'll show you some data in a minute to back that up. A landscape structure is certainly very important. It affects their movements, and you can think about that. Some work done at University of Florida by a guy by the name of Levy and cohorts with Tewksbury, where they looked at bluebirds in corridors, barriers, and edges, and the matrix is the part of the edge that's part of the barrier. So edge effect, other speakers have talked about that. Natural enemies, of course, are involved in this, so we wanted to exploit that. And basically the consensus is that you certainly have to deal with bug phenology, and food quality and movement are driving what's going on out there. Now, Glenn, my co-author, gave me these slides, some of which you've seen, to show her work in the peanut cotton farmscape and to show where the source and the sinks are in this, and demonstrating how the movement takes place and how that might be intercepted. And what she was thinking there, basically trying to figure out where and what they were doing in time and space, and then how we might counter that. Now, this is an example of some of her experiments trying to intercept Nazara by planting sorghum as a trap crop between cotton in corn cotton farmscapes. And this is the data that she has not shown this data this way, but basically you can see there that the southern green was highly attracted to sorghum, preferring sorghum to cotton, and so sorghum is potentially a trap crop there. And the same thing in the corn and cotton subplots where there was a corn cotton interface, same thing occurred there. So she looked at sorghum as an effective trap crop and barrier, if you will, and compared side-by-side plots where you had the trap crop with and without it, and you can see that the yellow outlines the statistically higher numbers in the cotton without the trap crop and lower in. So this is the kind of setup that she used, and my trap there, and those folks that are using that trap, you really need to pay attention to the details about how that should be deployed. I'll talk about that later if anybody's interested. She's also done the same thing with eustachys and peanut cotton. She has the same kind of data, and again, you get a reduction in number of stink bugs, and you get reduction as a result in the number of pesticide applications required. So that's kind of a targeted approach to trap cropping stink bugs in a specific habitat. My interest was more in developing a generic approach to this problem that could be used, again, philosophy and scale neutral. And I outlined this in XMind, and you can see this is fairly complex, and I've developed the hierarchy here, which I think are very important, and I put this out, I'll make a few comments later. Wherever you're going to put these things out, latitude is going to be very important in terms of when the crop and when the trap crop have to be coincident and in the right stage, and what stink bugs and natural enemies is going to be there. Logistics are extremely important. Landscape level from the movement, and all these other things are something that, if you're going to put this kind of thing together, have to be dealt with. All right, so basically what a trap crop is just a small area with highly competitive host. You place them adjacent to the trap crop. If you haven't read this simulation study by Potting et al. From 2005, which talks about the behavior and habitat management, I strongly recommend it. It supports what we're doing here very well. And of course, you want to minimize any side effects. A lot of plants have side effects like stimulation of nematodes and the like, or invasive type characters. It would be nice if we could combine this with other tactics. We want to have it available at all growing seasons, and it needs to be economically feasible. So the ideal feature for this would be that we would attract the required pests. We would have seeds available. They would be, we could grow them in a reasonably economic and effective fashion. You wouldn't have any side effects. You would have a long maturity time so that you can minimize the input cost of this. You want a good longevity of those. Retuning, I'll talk about in a minute. I haven't done much with the physical properties of these, but if you read Potting et al., you'll soon find out that physical properties are a very important aspect of intercepting and attracting insects to small areas. And I'm now referring to these as multifunctional plots because the plants that we're using not only enhance or can be used as trap crops, but they also enhance pollinators, other people have said. They enhance natural enemies, and they're also important for wildlife food. So just as a background here, there's been some other data about stink bugs, and this data is from an area-wide study that Jeremy Green and Ted Cottrell and I have done, which will be out in this next year, where we looked at the phenology of brown stink bugs, and this is just breaking it down from different types of commodities where the traps were, and basically this just tells us that the stink bugs are going through a number of generations, and if you trap them right, you have this background stuff, and while it may change in a particular crop, you have to be very careful about how you trap in order to detect that variation. So what you're trying to do here is you have a cash crop that you're growing in sometime during the year, and that can be anywhere from spring, summer to fall, even overwintering North Florida, South Florida. So you want a trap crop in here that provides the qualities that are going to interfere with the stink bugs managing to get to the cash crop. So these would be various potential ones. The real mechanism going on here is the preference of the various stink bugs for the growth stage of their food. And I think this is probably, at least it was to me, it was counterintuitive. I'll just run through a couple of slides here of various insects. So this is the growth stage of the plant, and we've got this in a plot, and we're looking at the percentage of bugs that are present on a particular growth stage over time. And most of the time there are multiple growth stages there, so they have a choice, and so we're just counting them where they are over time relative to the growth. And you can see that between species are different, and within species they differ by life stage. And this goes clear across. So the fallback position of anything like this would be to ring the crop, and we've done some of that. Like I said, Glenn and my work, we've been looking at where these things might be placed more strategically. That's a subject for another talk. And this is what we've come up with, is that in early spring, the cold temperatures of soil are prohibitive to the growth of sorghum and millets. So what we found is if you plant staggered plantings of triticale in the fall, combine that with crimson clover and hairy vetch, you can enhance your natural enemies as well as enhance your stink bug attraction. Then you come in spring and plant sunflower and buckwheat and perhaps barnyard grass in certain situations, and that gets you started. And then as the season progresses, then you add in these other plants that actually attract all of the species, all the main species. Now I'm using this word retuning, which just means mowing. And basically we're mowing these things back. Sorghum, for example, takes about 50 to 70 days to mature. It lasts about 3 or 4 weeks as attractive to the stink bugs. You then can mow that back about a half a meter high, and then it will come back in about 3 or 4 weeks, and when it comes back it is out of synchrony. That means you have the genetic individual plant genetics of phenology of manifesting itself, so you have a whole pile of the range of food quality available within that site. All right, and so what that does for you is it reduces the number of plantings, saves your input cost. The only problem is it's in the same location all the time, so you're not moving this around. So basically, the two things you can exploit here are the maturity range of the cultivars of the plants that you're using, and then whether you can retune them or not. Now, everything's not amenable to retuning that I've mentioned, but sorghum and millet certainly are. And so we have here, this is just an example of sorghum. You plant, say, 4 cultivars. They have different maturity dates, and then you retune them, and this is your functioning period. And so in this way, you can extend the length of your trap crop over time. Okay, I'm just gonna run through these very quickly. Tell you some of the characteristics of these various plants. Triticale is attractive to all the main species and most of the minor species of stink bugs and coreids. It does have a large range in cultivars that display various characteristics there that are exploitable. You can retune it, and it does have pollen that is very attractive to beneficials. And of course, it's cold hardy. Buckwheat, you can call this your mistake plant or your relay plant, more professionally, screw-up plant, whatever, because it only takes about 5 weeks to come to maturity, and therefore it's very quick, it's cheap and easy, it's available, and you can retune it, but because it grows so fast, it's really not necessary to retune it. It has a good soil temperature resistance. It is an potential organic crop in its own right, and is attractive not only to the stink bugs but to most of the parasites and a lot of predators as well. Sorghum, very well known, has a longer maturity date, ratoons well, great range in germplasm, a lot of natural enemies on it. It gets other herbivores that can serve as alternate hosts for natural enemies. It grows well in containers, which I'll talk about in a second, and it is an organic crop as well. Pyramellite is very similar. It's much taller, does have a wide range of cultivars, although they're not that particularly readily available. It does attract all the species, longer time, organic crop. This is one, even though it's called millet, it's a different genera altogether. And this one is very quick as well. It takes 6 to 7 weeks, tracks those as well as the stink bugs plus the natural enemies. It's about 3 to 4 feet in height, but the side effect of that is it can be invasive. Sunflower is very well known, of course. Charlie Rogers did volumes on this. It's planted all over the country. Very important for pollinators, natural enemies. Very attractive to the stink bugs that we're talking about. It grows well in containers. It has a lot of other herbivores on it that can serve as natural enemies. And it is now being looked at very heavily as a biodiesel crop. So it could be an important crop in that, from that standpoint as well. It does not retune. So those are the mainstays. There's been a tremendous amount of work done with field peas, and field peas are very good. The only problem is they're fairly short. They do have extra floral nectaries. They tend to have they tend to fall down and be very flat. So the other one, I'm putting these on the lower on the list because there are other plants they're working with that are better. Okra is excellent. The only trouble is it induces root knot nematodes. It has a lot of other herbivores that get on there. It has extra floral nectaries of being a hibiscus, attracts lots of beneficials, lots of pollinators, and it's cheap and easy to manage, and it works well in containers, and everybody knows about it. There are three other things that have been suggested. Sesbania, Jim Dutcher did some work with Sesbania in Georgia. I don't really like it very well. It doesn't attract most of the stink bugs as well as the other ones do, with the exception of Ebolus. If you're going to look for something for the rice stink bug, then this is very attractive to that. Indigofer is one. I think Jay mentioned this as one for Eucystis conspersus, but this does suppress nematodes, but it is very weedy, and I don't like it for that reason. And then Crotalaria, actually Crotalaria is illegal to grow in certain places, so that one's out too, even though it does have some characteristics. So there's one other one, a brown top millet, which could be used. It's much shorter than the rest of them. It is shorter in maturity. It's important for wildlife. Very good for Ebolus, so it would be one if you're doing for the rice stink bugs. But I think the other ones I've mentioned are better than this one. When I said philosophy neutral, this is what I was talking about. If people don't want to plant these things in one place, or you're an organic grower, backyard gardener, then you can actually grow these in pots and you can retune them and do everything else that you need to do if it's a stationary planting. And then I add in this visual attraction here on the right, which you can see is the same color as my stink bug trap. We've been doing some work with that. I have a paper this afternoon that is using that. You can attract natural enemies, and it will not only enhance the natural enemy attraction to that area, but it'll also enhance the stink bugs as well. So you're using a push-pull type approach. What we've done with this in terms of, well, does it work? We have protected a 2-acre organic soybean field pretty well with this. And Steve has done a similar thing using peas and corn. And of course, we have Glenn's work. And then, so here's what we have. And I'll take questions. Any questions? All right, that's the conclusion of the symposium, and we do have time for a discussion if anybody's interested. I don't know if anybody is interested or not, but we have a lot of stink bug knowledge here. If anybody wants to go, why, please go. I'll just throw out some things to folks. One of our problems is we don't have any really effective insecticides, and my question would be, does anybody think that there are going to be effective insecticides developed? Does anybody have a feel for that? Jeff?
I would say, I don't know anything about insecticides, but I know that find stink bugs and say they don't really want to talk to me about anything that I know, but sometime I predict they'll have genes and plants for stink bugs.
Well, this milky stage type preference for most of these species with all these things that I worked on. Anybody else have any experience with that? I mean, that to me, that's really the key. If the plants aren't in that stage, then the stink bugs really aren't on them. And so you have to maintain that. You know, to have this trap crop going like this, you need to have that continuously. And so it's not going to work without it. And the other thing that I didn't say, but this goes back to the placement of it, is most of this, most of the stink bugs are moving continuously from one landscape to the other, crop to crop, and you have to intercept them before they get in the crop. Once they're in there, you're not going to get them out. And that's the problem with the pheromones, because the pheromones usually, in some cases, mean food, or at least that's part of what the signal is, and so they're landing short of them, and we're in the acoustical drumming and stuff, we're not going to have probably really good detection and monitoring systems anytime soon either. Anybody want to comment on that? So if we don't have these tools available, then folks, what are we going to do? Then we're forced to back up to really understanding what's happening at the landscape level at different levels of resolution. And each species has a different behavior in terms of how it responds to structure. And some of them, Glenn can tell you in her work, stink bugs will go down a corn row long before they'll go across a corn row. And that goes back to the Tewsbury work, Tewsbury and Levy's work, where they were working with bluebirds. And everybody thinks, well, birds get up and they fly like birds. But actually, birds don't fly like birds either. But stink bugs don't do that either. In that study, they did a huge cutout of open areas in the Savannah National Forest, and then they looked at how the blueberries responded to the berry structure. And so we see a tremendous edge effect, which is exploitable, but if the food's not there, then all bets are off. They're not responding to structure. They're actually going to act like birds. So that's what we're up against. Anybody else want to chime in here? Yes, ma'am. Go ahead.
I just have kind of a two-parter, I guess. First, kind of a cost comparison between what you were doing with your trap cropping versus some of I'm not as familiar with the whole system, so I was just curious in terms of kind of a cost analysis between utilizing trap cropping and then the alternative of if you're saving yourself some insecticide sprays, that part of it. And then secondly, that kind of leads into grower adoption. And I can understand that maybe some of the smaller productions, maybe organic or niche market, kind of are looking maybe to implement some of these a little bit more readily. But is it possible that we can? So what are your thoughts on that?
Anybody want to comment on that before I do? Well, I think there's a great deal of resistance to adoption of Rube Goldberg devices like this. I mean, that's just, everybody wants to spray. But the fact of the matter is if they're not effective, it doesn't make sense. And certainly this edge effect, which Jay showed, and the landscape interactions with the interface are exploitable, and that's what they're going to have to rely on. Now, as far as the cost goes, most of the stuff that I'm talking about is fairly cheap and available. I haven't done a costing out of what it was, mainly because we don't have enough implementation of it, really. We're not that far yet. But I did make the Mother Earth news, so I thought, got to be cool. That's about the extent of it. But I think it will, from this standpoint, I think it will hold up very well, and that is when we start to understand that the source and sink in the landscape. I mean, people think that bugs are generally distributed all over the place, and in fact, the opposite is true. They are highly aggregated. What we need to know, and Glenn showed that very well in some of her maps there, where even one chinaberry tree off on the side was enough to show up in the sampling. And when we understand that kind of stuff, and just like Jay was doing, then you know where to place these various tools, and then you intercept them there. And there are other things you can do too, because there are bottlenecks where they're overwintering or coming out over winter, where you can really suppress them, hit them hard early in the season before they build up and move. And there are a lot of other things that would go with that. And one of the things I see with the pheromone is that even though we may not have it conventionally used as a detection and monitoring tool, we can certainly use it in a push-pull situation to not only get the herbivores and the natural enemies in coincidence in the trap crops, but also to concentrate them there and be able to treat a smaller area. Now, organic folks aren't going to spray them, and certainly anybody that's trying to enhance beneficials doesn't want to spray the trap crops. But Philip was talking about actually spraying cotton fields, and I think that's probably where they're going to start off. And as they realize that that's working and they start thinking about, well, what the mechanism is, then we'll go down to, well, hell, I don't need to spray that whole field. I just need to spray that 20 feet that's right across from the chinaberry. That's probably the way it'll go. Anybody else want to weigh in on that?
If you trap a spin bug on any crop on the trap, does that mean necessarily that a spin on that crop goes for, if I compare to the leaf hopper, and that if you trap the insect on the trap in the crop, it doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to feed on that crop. They can be just, can you do any comparison between leaf hopper and spin bug?
Well, the origin of that question is from my environmental forum paper, which was published this year about glassy-winged sharpshooter, which has a lot of parallels with stink bugs. And I think the question is, if you trap stink bugs in a particular place, does that mean that those host plants there are the ones that they're feeding on? Categorically, no, but usually, yeah, there's something there. Because for example, when I put out my trap with the pheromone, typically what you find in North Florida, South Georgia, you catch about 10 to 20 per week over a period of a couple weeks. And then it goes down and it stabilizes about 5 to 10 adults per week. Now, then when you start looking at the individual traps, it's highly dependent on what type of vegetation is surrounding it. If you have a trap where there are a lot of weeds around it, then that trap is going to have higher numbers. But it's very difficult to pull them out of a crop once they're in it. So if they get in a peach orchard, you're not gonna bring them back out. You got to get them before they go in. But no, it does not mean that they're feeding on that particular host, because they do move around quite a bit. And the oviposition host and the nymph host are not the same as the adult host by any stretch of the imagination. Michael?
Do you see that trap as being solely for detection, or can that be used for monitoring where it would actually reflect a change in population density?
Oh, no, I think it accurately, for Eustis service, it accurately reflects what's there. And in small areas, I think it suppresses them. I mean, it takes them out. Because you're going to, given a situation where the plants around it are not preferred plants, you know, I mean, if you've got a half acre of buckwheat or sorghum or whatever, it's not going to do that. But if you don't, when they're moving through the landscape like he's talking about, yeah, I think it would. Yeah. But that remains to be shown. I hope you show that. Go ahead. Yeah.
I'm not a plant entomologist, but I have a little bit of experience with stink bugs. You really only have two ways to go. If you're going to try to avoid pesticides completely, that's a good goal. But either you're going to work with knowing the biology of the stink bugs, so you really know what they're feeding on. Once you know what they're feeding on before you're going to plant the crop, it doesn't matter if it's rice, soybean, whatever. Once you know what they're feeding on, then you know the timing. So it's either you're going to concentrate on what they prefer. Once you know that, you then use trap crops. When you ask them, if your crops that you are using, which they've done on soybean, Then you plant the soybeans that take longer to mature, so you're trying to just break up that cycle. Because once they reproduce, they're going to have that migratory period where they're going to take off.